This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Box office top 10, and your comments welcome, of course. At number 10, National Treasure, Book of Secrets.
The most interesting thing about National Treasure, Book of Secrets is that yesterday I went on a sightseeing trip around Philadelphia, which is where I am in training for our runoff next week, and there was about three or four locations that featured in the original National Treasure, and that is more interesting than anything else that's in the whole of the rest of National Treasure, Book of Secrets, is that I saw the graveyard that Nick Cage walked through.
Rambo at 9.
Terrible, awful, rubbish. And again, there's been a lot of discussion about this, about whether or not one ought to be able to, you know, kick Rambo for being politically suspect, because, you know, in the end it's Rambo. I like Rocky VI. I mean, despite the fact that Sylvester Stallone had told me personally in Cannes at the end of the 90s, you know, I wouldn't go back and do another Rocky movie and I wouldn't go back and do another Rambo movie. And then, of course, he does both of them. And, of course, apparently he was working on the script for Rambo the day after 9/11 started. And originally it was this holy war story, and it has been reined in from that. But it is a really obnoxious, stupid movie. And it's terrific to see there was one major cinema chain refused to take it. And it's terrific to see that it limped into the box office so poorly, because it is absolute rubbish.
Untraceable is at number 8.
Which is one of those strange cases in which you see a movie which has got an A-list star and a bunch of multi-million dollar backers behind it, and you think it's funny. I'm sure I've seen this movie on straight to video and straight to DVD. It's one of those things about websites are evil and bad. There are websites out there with people doing terrible things. The gizmo this time is the more people that log on to the website, the faster the terrible thing happens. It's sore with A-levels. And it was interesting, you know, in your conversation with Andy Serkis, I have very, very severe reservations about The Cottage. In fact, Andy Serkis came up to me at the BAFTAs, very much like Helen Mirren did last year, and said, what do you mean it's not a proper film? And said, why don't you like The Cottage? More of which when we actually come to review it. But the Untraceable is very, you know, it's just a nasty straight-to-video movie with A-levels.
Yeah, he told me, actually, just that when we finished in the recording for the interview, he told me to say something rude to you because you didn't like the movie. This is an interesting trend started by Benedict Cumberbatch a few weeks back when he actually punched you for your comments about Keira Knightley, and I wonder if this is going to be an increasing trend this year, that when we get actors coming in, they actually want to enact physical violence on you for being wrong.
Well, thanks for putting that idea into the public imagination, Simon, and I look forward to the first time it happens and I have you to blame for it. No, listen, I am all in favour of people having the right to reply. I think that's absolutely great. And, of course, in the case of Andy Serkis, I mean, I love Andy Serkis. I think he's a brilliant actor, and I really wanted to like The Cottage because I like London to Brighton, and The Cottage is partly filmed in the Isle of Man. But, you know, I saw it and I didn't like it at all, and I can't lie about it. And so I said, I don't like it at all, and Andy said to me, why don't you like it at all? And I kind of did my best to explain it to him. But, you know, you can't... It's one of those things. You cannot lie to people about liking their work. It'll just get you into trouble.
There Will Be Blood at number 7. Now, just some correspondence on this, which continues to come in. David Rush, Simon and the Good Doctor, just seen There Will Be Blood. I am still speechless. All I will say is it's stunning. It's a cinematic masterpiece. The score, acting, direction, cinematography was phenomenal. The sense of scale, impending doom and comedy, albeit in small doses. I've never been so shell-shocked by a movie that affected each one of my emotions, and it seemed to go subconsciously through it, despite the fact I had no idea what was going on. I'm still speechless, and I might just go and see it again, which sounds almost like a paraphrase of what you've been talking about for the last few weeks.
I think that's exactly the right response. Of course, I'm very pleased that they pointed out the score there, because, of course, the great travesty of the Oscars this year is that Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead wrote this incredible score, and then it was disqualified at the last moment because certain sections of the score had been performed previously. I believe had been performed previously on the BBC, and there was a general feeling that one of the other nominees had been the person who had nobbled the Oscar committee and said, oi, you need to disqualify this, knowing full well that if There Will Be Blood had been allowed to compete in the Best Original Score category, it would have won hands down, because it was clearly the Best Original Score of the year. And I gave my Kermode Award for Best Score to Johnny Greenwood. Of course, I mean, I don't know Radiohead from a hole in the ground, but I just thought the score was absolutely wonderful. And we still have to top the letter of the guy who went to see it and came out to discover that Camden had burnt to the ground, which he thought was, you know, actually completely appropriate, because the movie does have that overwhelming effect. You come out of it thinking that, you know, that the world has fundamentally changed. It's a great piece of cinema, and it probably should have won Best Director.
Rick in Stoke Newington, I took your advice on There Will Be Blood. I choose to emphasise the will when I say it. Refer listeners to previous correspondence. And when to see it Thursday lunchtime. I only just managed to avoid being directly next to any, despite the first person in the cinema. This is, again, previous correspondence about how Mark thinks you should book out the seat in front and to left and right and behind you as well for maximum impact. There was no doubt I was entranced from the first frame by the amazing look of the film, the settings, the performances, and came out of it slightly confused. I'm not sure I enjoyed the film as such, but like I say, I was entranced by it, and I'm going to go and see it again. And P.S., I listened to last week's podcast afterwards, laughing out loud on the bus. Thanks for making me the weirdo on the bus. Keep up the good work. Number six, Be Kind, Rewind.
You know, it's a one-joke movie, and as far as Michel Gondry's films are concerned, it's not one of his best because it's not a Charlie Kaufman script, and I still think he needs to work with a scriptwriter other than himself. It is, however, a lot easier to get on with than The Science of Sleep, which was just like, you know, being messed around in his head for a while. And the fact is, I found it charming and sweet and funny. The story is, you know, Jack Black and Mos Def work in a video store, the videotapes get blanked, and they have to remake all the films, including things like Ghostbusters and Driving Miss Daisy. And it's quirky, and a little bit of quirk goes a very long way. And by the end of it, it had, you know, I didn't want it to go on any longer, although apparently you can go to the website and see all the movies that they Sweeded, this being the term for them, their remakes, all the rest of the stuff that's not in the film itself. And so, you know, there is more out there if you want it. But I thought by the time I got to the end of the movie, I'd had enough, but I did enjoy it.
Juno at five.
Fantastic to see Diablo Cody winning Best Screenplay. A shame that having written such a fantastic screenplay, she then gave such a lousy Oscar acceptance speech because she was so clearly trying hard not to cry. But then the message of this is, if you get up on the Oscar stage, don't invoke your family. And please don't say, I want to thank my family for loving me the way I am, because of course you're going to burst into tears. It's just what happens.
The Accidental Husband is at number four.
The accidentally terrible... I mean, Uma Thurman. You put Irma in a room next door to Keira Knightley and say, which of these two is the most woody actress? And I think, to be honest, Irma's got the edge. I mean, I know that I've been very rude about Keira Knightley, and I have been punched on the arm, as you quite rightly pointed out, as a result of it, by one of her co-stars. But I'll be nice about her in this respect. She is so much of a better actress than Irma Theakston. I mean, really. In comparison with Irma Theakston, she's Katharine Hepburn.
Jumper at three.
It's silly science fiction, tomorrow people rip off, now in new clothes, with Hayden Christensen, who's still most famous for not being very good as Anakin Skywalker, now being famous for not being as good as Jamie Bell in Jumper.
Semi-pro at two.
Semi-pro. And in fact, you've just made a pun that I wish I'd made up. Semi-pro. That's exactly what it is. That's curse you for coming up with
just
that.
Just trying to help.
And from now on, I'm going to refer to it as that. It is. It is the standard. How many yards of a Will Ferrell comedy would you like? Let's do it about you know, some naff old sport and put it in the 70s so we can wear an afro and big flared trousers. And let's call it samey pro, because it is just more than Simon. I'm so cross now that I didn't do that. Bother.
Straight to the heart of the periphery, as you always say. And yes. The UK's number one movie is The Bank Job.
It's Jason Statham. He's a bit of a geezer, and they got to do this bank job. And the thing is, oh, it's right larky, because they got to get into this vault. And then when they're in this vault, blimey, Charlie, they find all these pictures of the royal family, and they're getting up to all manner of shenanigans. And then they got the MI5 and the MI6, they're all involved, and, you know, strike a light, Struth. It's all based on a true story in it. And it's sort of like that. And it's okay, and it's quite good fun. And in fact, of all the movies that came out last week, it was probably the best one, because it just did exactly what it said on the tin. I mean, I quite like Jason Statham, although I have to say I tend towards the movies in which he, you know, he does naked oil wrestling rather more than this, but it's perfectly fine. And it's directed by, you know, a perfectly serviceable director, Roger Donaldson. He's a, you know, good New Zealand filmmaker. It's nothing to write home about. I don't know what they're going to make of it over here. It's just it's playing in America now, and I don't know whether they have to get subtitles for it, because otherwise... I don't understand what Jason Statham is saying, although all Jason Statham is saying most of the time is, blimey, strike a light, cool, love a duck. The other Bowling Girl sort of, you know, bodice-ripping, head-lopping story of Henry VIII's ongoing attempts to sire an heir, based on a novel by Philip Chadwick. First done for television, I think, in 2003. I didn't see the TV version, although, interestingly enough, the TV version is available on video with a 15 certificate, and the film only has a 12 certificate, more of which later. So this new version, now readapted by Peter Morgan, he of The Deal and The Queen and Longford, of course, which you were talking to, Andy, circus about before. Last King of Scotland, most recently Frost Nixon. And I think he also wrote the Ray Winston Henry VIII. So he is like the political writer of our days. So essentially what you've got is like Anne of a Thousand Days with added corsets and politics. Story is, Henry is married to the woman who's always referred to as Catherine the Arrogant, who, according to the movie, is a woman of a certain age and is therefore unable to provide him with the son what he does not yet have. Enter David Morrissey. Now, every movie picks up the minute David Morrissey walks on, particularly when David Morrissey walks in. Hello, David, and hello to Jason Isaacs. Particularly when David Morrissey walks on wearing a big sort of floppy hat, being sinister. And he is the ultra-sinister Duke of Norfolk. And because the last thing he was in, written by Peter Morgan, he played Gordon Brown in The Deal. And some of that sinister, shifty quality is filtered over here. And basically what happens is
What are you saying about our Prime Minister?
I'm saying that the way in which David Morrissey plays the shiftiness of the Duke of Norfolk in this movie owes something to the shiftiness of the character that he plays in The Deal. Now, obviously, these characters are... You know, what's that disclaimer? These characters are entirely fictional and any resemblance to anybody living or dead is completely coincidental. So within the frame of that, also Gordon Brown seems a bit shifty to me, but what do I know? I'm a film critic. So anyway, so the deal is he gets the Boleyn father to basically put his daughters forward to become mistresses of Henry VIII. And they seem to be very happy to do this. And at first, the person he's put forward isn't Anne, it's Mary. And Mary, played by Natalie Portman, who, as everybody knows, he's multilingual, very, very intelligent, and also played Queen Padme Amidala in the Star Wars movies. But clearly, Henry VIII hasn't seen the Star Wars movies, doesn't fancy her, fancies Scarlett Johansson's Anne Boleyn, for which crime alone he should have been thrown off the throne as it was. Anyway, here is a not particularly representative clip, but a clip that does sort of represent the movie in the way it wants to be represented in the publicity. Here we go.
Look at you. Younger than me. More beautiful than me. Married before me. I'm eclipsed. I'm the other Boleyn girl. Hardly.
So is this it, Mrs. Carey? Do we lose you now forever?
No, never. I'll be married, that's all. Apart from that, it won't change a thing. Come, George. Let's leave our sister. She needs to make herself pretty.
Okay, now, smart listeners will realise immediately that I'm getting me Marys and me Annes confused, so I apologise for doing that. But it is confusing, because basically there's the two sisters, there's Mary and Anne, and he's meant to be interested in Mary, but then he's interested in Anne, and then that doesn't work out, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Now, the backstory of all of this is that it is, in fact, quite a dark story, because as the Boleyn's mother points out at one point, played by Kristen Scott Thomas, she said, what's happening is that our daughters are being used as bargaining chips for power between men. And it's a very, very grim side to the story. And Henry VIII is played by Eric Banner. And I really like Eric Banner. And I always liked Eric Banner playing psychos. I mean, the first thing I ever saw him in was Chopper, in which he played Mark Chopper Reed, who's this psycho who was introduced to us as a character who, whilst he's in prison, is remodeling his own ears with home implements. And he's very good at doing psychos. And Henry VIII clearly was, at points in his life, completely psychopathic. So what you have is the Peter Morgan script, which is essentially about the rupture between church and state, which again is very, very significant at the moment, because you had all this stuff with the Archbishop of Canterbury. And of course, there's one scene in the movie in which Henry VIII, having broken with Rome, having effectively established the Church of England, that's the sound of a large drill going on overhead. Rushes in and, then grabs Natalie Portman to find out whether or not this terrible political thing that he's just done is actually worth it in purely physical terms. Now, a number of problems. The first one is this. Scarlett Johansson can't act to save her life, and I am looking forward to the point at which Scarlett Johansson is in a movie with Keira Knightley and with Irma Theakston, and they have an absolute act off. And I would invite people to text in and tell me who they think is the worst of those three actresses. But Scarlett Johansson is absolutely the best thing about Scarlett Johansson is that she is the responsible for the only good joke in the St. Trinians movie, when the girls in St. Trinians learn that an art thief is about to steal the girl with the pearl earring, and they say, "Oh blimey, she's going to kidnap Scarlett Scarlett Johansson, boom, boom, and that's it. That's pretty much the best thing that she's responsible for. What you get here is Scarlett Johansson not being able to act, Natalie Portman being pretty good, Eric Bana not really being given the opportunity to do Henry as psychotically as he ought to be doing, and then David Morrissey doing all the political shenanigans in the background in what appears to be a slightly different movie. So the problem with it is it can't decide whether it really wants to be a kind of a sort of quite nice, trashy, bodice-ripping story, or whether what it actually wants to be is this dark, foul story about the abuse of women, about the unholy marriage between church and state, about political shenanigans that end up with people getting their heads lopped off, about courtly intrigue that's not nice and romantic and people talking behind behind fans and things, but is actually brutal and nasty and treats everybody as some kind of commodity. And the problem with the film is it wants to have its cake and eat it. And I felt watching it that on the one hand you had this script which had these ambitions, on the other hand you had the film being directed by somebody who was in the end trying to bring it in as a 12A certificate. And it's really interesting that if you look at the BBFC version of why it's a 12A certificate, they say there's a couple of scenes that imply sexual activity. There is the scene in which the king, you know, forces himself upon Anne Boleyn. And then there are undetailed references to the consummation of marriage, a couple of executions, and brief but undetailed references to incest. Interestingly enough, nothing in the film about Anne Boleyn having six fingers, which if you're doing history at the moment, that was one of the claims against her, was that she was a witch because she had six fingers, but they clearly figured they weren't going to go to that length and do that. But there's all this stuff in it. I mean, you know, it's incest and violence and political, and yet it's a 12A certificate movie. And I think the problem with it is it's neither fish nor fowl. If it wanted to be something that was acceptable for school kids, and this really isn't, I mean, believe me, this is not. I mean, I think it's actually much closer to being a 15 certificate movie. It's not something for younger school kids. It's too dark for that. But on the other hand, if you're old enough to really understand what the subject matter is about, it's not grim enough to do that subject matter justice. So it ends up falling between two stools. There are things in it that are good. I like David Morrissey. Some critics have been quite rude about him, but I think that's simply because he looks like he's in a different film. There's a great performance by Mark Rylance. There is some very, very good scripting stuff. And Eric Bana is certainly the most six-packed Henry VIII I've ever seen. But in the end, it can't decide whether it wants to be one thing or the other. So it ends up being interesting, but essentially a bit rubbish.
Just a reminder that Mark and I are signed up to do our bit for the Sport Relief Mile or Two at a location famous in the history of British cinema. It's all tied in with Chariots of Fire, and Mark will be doing reviews, and I'll kind of be jogging behind, trying to keep up with his lightning speed. If you want to support our running exploits by giving a donation to Sport Relief, you can click on the links on this program's page or the Sport Relief part of the Five Live website. The Driller is back. The Doctor is back, live from Philadelphia. And on the subject of six fingers, which you were talking about with the other Boleyn girl, of course, the link with the Princess Bride, Alistair in Derbyshire. My seven-year-old son got completely spooked by the bloke with six fingers. Nightmares for days, which is a shame, says Alistair, because I loved it. Any other six-fingered movies that occur to you, Mark?
No, I mean, that is the obvious one, which it prompts the, my name is Inigo Montoya, you killed my father, prepare to die. Which is just a wonderful thing. And anybody else, let us know of any other six. No, there's Hands of Orlac is just ordinary 10 fingers, isn't there? No, I think that is pretty much the only. And of course, the relevance here is that they don't give her six fingers, because it was one of those things that it was. There's a word for it, and the word is something like polydactyly, which is the word for having six fingers.
Could your driller just make up his mind? Either he wants to continue drilling, or he just wants to stop. If he just goes on and on and then stops all the way between now and 4 o'clock, it'll be very annoying. Could you get one of your?
No, I know. Well, unfortunately, apparently he's two floors down, but they said that it's going to make me feel at home because it's the sound of Driller Killer and it's the sound of charnel houses and that kind of stuff. And actually, I'm quite like being surrounded by the sound of great big industrial implements doing untold damage a couple of floors down.
On the important issue of applauding in a cinema, Alan in Sunderland. Sorry, but I think that's Alan. Actually, I remember kids in the cinema cheering as the house lights went down. Also, remember the whole audience cheering when the shark in Jaws was blown up. Ian says I used to clap at the titles when I was 10. I was so excited at the prospect of the film that was about to be shown. Now I clap at the same point because at last the unbelievably boring adverts have finally finished. And this from Jim in Walthamstow, probably the longest text of the day. Simon, recently Kermode the Esteemed perpetrated an awful falsehood with spurious authority. He claimed butterfly derived from flutterby. This is a nice etymological error from the 18th century. If he returns to 13th century poems, for example, Floris and Blancheflower, he will find forms known as butterfluger.
You're making that up,
no,
aren't you?
No, this is Butterflugger, based on the old notion that the insects, or witches disguised as butterflies, consume butter or milk that is left uncovered. This is where butterfly comes from. Another theory connects it to the colour of the insect's excrement, based on the Dutch word butterscheiter. I apologise for that. But it's all 100% true.
But then, I'm proud to stand corrected, because the fact of the matter is that we do have a sort of higher class of listener here who does, you know, email in with degrees from Cambridge and all the rest of it. And I'm heartbroken about it, because I was told this. I was one of those things that, you know, you're sitting around a dinner and somebody says, "Did you know where the word butterfly comes from?" And I absolutely love that sort of thing. And he absolutely assured me that
it's actually more interesting than that. It's based on the notion that insects consume butter or milk.
It's based on the notion that insects have poo that's the colour of butter or milk, which will go down very well with my kids. Thanks for that.
What else do we have that's new and interesting, or just Diary new?
Diary of the Dead, the new movie by George Romero. Now, George Romero is very if you're a horror fan, he's a legendary director. He made the trilogy of Dead movies, which each one covered a decade and covered a specific political problem. Night of the Living Dead, 1960s, was to do with racism and civil unrest. 1970s, Dawn of the Dead, which was absolutely about consumerism, zombies in a shopping mall. 1980s, Day of the Dead, which was kind of about vivisection, also to some degree about slavery. Then you had this little hiatus, which was then broken recently with Land of the Dead, which actually, of all the Dead movies, was probably the most mainstream. It's still a George Romero movie, so it's still substantial. And it was kind of about modern America, and it was about class distinctions and that sort of stuff. And then in the middle of that, there was a remake of Dawn of the Dead by Zack Snyder. It's also been a remake of Night of the Living Dead. Now, Romero comes back to the Dead. Well, it was a trilogy, and then it was a quadrilogy, and now it's a quintet or something. Anyway, so now, back with Diary of the Dead, which, as has become the way of things nowadays, is done as a found video diary. So I'll play you a clip in a moment that will set this up, but bear in mind that this movie is now coming not as the first movie to do this, but hot on the heels of Cloverfield, in which the whole gag about Cloverfield is... It's a videotape that was meant to be a videotape of somebody's leaving party, ended up being a videotape of alien invasion. But also, we look back to things like the Blair Witch Project, The Last Broadcast, I suppose Series 7, The Contenders, and before that, Man Bites Dog. This is not a new idea, although it is done well in Diary of the Dead. Here's a clip.
We downloaded a lot of what we found on television, on the net, off blogs, images and commentary over those first 3 days. None of it was useful. This is what we were getting from the news networks.
None of us can claim to know exactly what has caused the chaos we've been experiencing.
Some kind of germ, some kind
a natural
epidemic.
Calamity or
you can't talk
some sort
about
of massive or monstrous hoax.
I'm
old enough to remember Orson Welles' War of the Worlds, possibly the greatest hoax ever perpetrated. And that was when it was just radio. Now it's 24/7.
This is some kind of hoax.
This is ridiculous.
Willing to believe almost anything.
We made a film. The one I'm going to show you now. Actually, Jason was the one who wanted to make it. Like that cameraman from Channel 10, he wanted to upload it so that people, you, could be told the truth. The film was shot with a Panasonic HDX900 and an HVX200. I did the final cut on Jason's laptop. I've added music occasionally for effect, hoping to scare you. You see, in addition to trying to tell you the truth, I am hoping to scare you so that maybe you'll wake up. Maybe you won't make any of the same mistakes that we made. Anyway, here it is. Jason Creed's The Death of Death.
Which I think you'll agree is a pretty sort of solid opening, and it hits all the right buttons. It does all the stuff about the YouTubification of modern culture. It has in jokes about when really horrible news footage is uploaded, immediately the internet goes mad and everybody starts downloading it immediately. It isn't original, and it's also not the best of this particular format. There's a Spanish film coming up called Rec, you know, close brackets, REC, as in record, which does this kind of thing even better. On the positive side, Romero is a very intelligent filmmaker. He has stuff to say. He's always got substance beneath the gore. I mean, his films are gory. They are scary. They are, genuinely quite gruey. But they've also got intellectual meat. I mean, this isn't, I don't think, as scary as any of the other Dead movies. It is, however, impressively grim. I mean, it has a kind of grim, relentless quality, which I admire. And I like the fact that he's not making a movie which has jolly, upbeat elements to it. It's not. It's a movie that starts at a point of no hope and kind of goes downhill from there. It's not cutting edge. It's not classic. And it's not absolutely groundbreaking in the way that films like Night of the Living Dead, and I think Dawn of the Dead was, because I still think that Dawn of the Dead is the great underrated part of that trilogy. But it's a good, solid attempt to reinvigorate what has become a franchise. It does have a certain amount of stuff to say. It's done with the usual panache. And it's, in comparison with so much of the stuff that's around today, films like Saw and films like Hostel and, you know, what was ridiculously referred to as torture porn, but actually just meant a whole bunch of stupid adolescent nitwit boys making films with a bunch of stuff in it but no thematic substance. It is good to see that George Romero can still find a place to make these kind of movies. It's not a classic, but it's pretty solid.
And do the zombies, I mean, are they updated like 28 days later and 28 weeks later? We talk about, you know, because they can run.
Yes.
Do these zombies run or not?
It's not to do with running. I mean, it's funny because the remake of Dawn of the Dead, the one thing that added was fast zombies. And when 28 Days Later came out, everybody said, oh, look, this is the really interesting thing. Is because the thing is, in 28 Days Later, they're not zombies. As Danny Boyle kept pointing out, as Alex Garland kept pointing out as well, they're not zombies because they're not dead. What they are is they're infected, which is a different thing. So in theory, Dawn of the Dead, the remake by Zack Snyder, was in fact the first fast zombie movie, and this isn't walking in the shadow of that. It doesn't need to rely on a kind of on speed trials in order to make you think, oh, that's original, because it's not trying to be desperately original in what it's saying. I think that Romero thinks that the video diary thing is slightly more cutting edge than it actually is. That idea has been around with us for a very long time, and in fact, Michael Haneke's film Funny Games, which he recently remade from the Austrian original, he remade it in American, and again, that uses that videotape format thing again, as does Benny's Video, the film he made before that. So it's not a new thing, but it's done solidly. And I just like George Romero. It's good to see him still, you know, chipping away at the coalface and still making movies that are meant to be grim. They're not meant to be that much fun.
Six-fingered movies, because of Anne Boleyn and also because of The Princess Bride, is why we're on this. Toby says, Mark and Simon, Toby here at Lancaster University. Just thinking, didn't the Penguin from Batman have a total of six fingers? James in Preston, the concert pianist that Ethan Hawke and Irma Theakston go to see in Gattaca, had six fingers. Conflicting evidence about Bruce Almighty. Stephen Huddersfield said he had six fingers briefly. Mark in Sheffield says he got eight fingers from God. Does that count? Ian thinks he had seven fingers. Jay in Durham says Hannibal Lecter had six fingers. John in London, six-fingered man in a bar at the start of Get Carter. Martin Jameson says Simon and Mark recently wrote an episode of Holby City featuring a man with six toes on one foot. Does that count? No, I don't think so. And Marcus on this says, see you and raise you, the 5,000 fingers of Dr. T. Which was a Dr. Seuss movie from 1953.
That is fantastic. Now that I think of the picture of Jim Carrey with his hand up in front of his face, which is the picture from Bruce Almighty, you're right, I haven't got any idea whether it's six, seven or eight. Actually, now thinking about it, I'm inclining more towards seven, because it's a one-shot gag when, in order to prove that he is God, Morgan Freeman gives him extra fingers, and that may well be right, that it is seven on one hand. I don't remember there being the six-fingered guy in Get Carter, but I'm sure that is right. I just simply don't remember it. But that's how fantastic that there are all those six-fingered characters out there. And in that case, shame on the makers of The Other Boleyn Girl for not having the guts to stand by their principles and give Queen Padmé Amidala six fingers.
There's stacks of emails and texts from people saying a six-fingered man in Get Carter, so clearly that is there. We might have hit on a whole new genre. So I told you about The Other Boleyn Girl and Diary of the Dead. Vantage Point next.
Can I just also say that what's happened now is we've downshifted from drilling into hammering, so clearly the first level of torture has been gone through, and they're now onto the second level, so let's just see how that pans out.
The hacksaw is just moments away.
It is, and I'm looking forward to a cameo role by Lucio Fulci, that joke for the horror fans only. Anyway, Vantage Point, which is, as the adverts keep telling us, the number one thriller at the American box office. Number of taglines, can you solve the puzzle? Eight strangers, eight points of view, one truth. It's a modern thriller which sees itself as a modern version of Rashomon. Now, obviously, Simon, you know what Rashomon is, don't you?
Sorry, just lost the line there.
OK, obviously, Simon, you know what Rashomon is, don't you?
No, still can't. Is there a driller I could listen to?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, of course I can. No, I've never heard of it. Oh, what is it?
Okay, fine, thank you. So Rashomon, 19... Had the line actually gone dead, or was that just an extended gag from you?
The latter.
Okay, fine. Well, boom, and if you will, boom. You see, the thing
do
is,
tell us about Rashomon.
You.
I'm really interested.
I know. Well, I can't see you. I don't get the gags. All right. So here we go. So 1950s, a Japanese movie by Kurosawa. One crime scene from a number of different points of view. It's a classic movie. When people say something is Rashomon-like, what they mean is it's a multiple perspective telling of a story. However, very few of the things which refer to themselves as Rashomon-like deserve the title.
What about
Rashomon-like.
Usual Suspects? Is that Rashomon-like?
Actually, funnily enough, that's not a terrible example, but the problem with Usual Suspects is it's all seen effectively from one point of view. That one point of view is shifting and wrong, but that one point of view is a totally false movie. So, in fact, no, now that you've said it, it's completely the opposite of Rashomon-like, because all we hear is the version which is the Kevin Spacey movie. So, no, Simon, of all the movies you could have picked, actually, that's pretty much the wrongest of all of
it's
them.
It's anti-Rashomon-like, then.
It is. So the story is, American president turns up on stage at a big conference in Spain and is promptly shot. Or is he? Begins with Sigourney Weaver as a TV boss trying to get her person on the ground to be a fantastic TV presenter. And then the bad stuff happens. Here's a clip.
You go wide, four, you're in close. I want to start with the leaders and end with the mayor.
Thank you so much. For
good.
This summit could very well be the defining moment
pull
for this
presidency. Pull out four, three.
Oh, my God.
The president appears to have been shot.
Free, stick with the president. Just stay with him. Hold it there.
This is insane.
Angie, please tell us what you're seeing.
Okay, Angie, you're on. Let's go.
The president of the United States has been shot.
Okay, so the film then flits back between several perspectives. So what you get is you get the point of view of Dennis Quaid, who's a Secret Service man who was previously wounded in action. You get the point of view of Forrest Whitaker, who's a tourist in the crowd who's got a video camera that's accidentally recorded the events. You get this point of view of another special agent who's slightly more sinister than Dennis Quaid. And you keep going back and seeing the same half an hour of time. I mean, it's meant to be half an hour, but it actually plays out in 10-minute segments over and over again. Now, here's the thing. It's directed by Pete Travis, who directed Omar and has worked with Paul Greengrass in the past. And in a way, the problem with this is that Paul Greengrass has so fundamentally changed the playing field when it comes to doing, you know, really gritty docudramas. There's very, very few people can do what Paul Greengrass does. So the opening chaos in the crowd scenes are pretty convincingly done. And for the first 20 minutes, this idea about you're seeing an event played out on a stage and now you're going to see it from a different angle just about works. But two things start to happen after the first half an hour. The first one is the flashback device starts to become boring and it starts to remind you of Groundhog Day. And you start to expect to hear I Got You, Babe play every time they go back to the midday time thing to begin all over again. You think, oh, here we go again. How many more perspectives have we got to go through? The second one is that although it begins in a very 70s parallax for you kind of way, you know, it's all grim and strange and you know, not sure how this is going to work out and it's all to do with the media, it very, very quickly loses its nerve and downshifts into absolutely mad action. And it's like some great big Hollywood producer said, you know what I really want? I want a film that's like that Rashomon. But the problem with Rashomon was, what with it being in a Japanese movie in the 1950s, it didn't have enough exploding helicopters in it. So can you do me that? But can you do some more chase sequences like that one in The French Connection? Can you do some big explosions? Can you do some, you know, edge of the seat peril? And of course, what happens is, on the one hand, the movie is pulling you in this way, which is, oh, look, it's complicated. We're seeing all these things from different angles, and that's an intellectual conceit, and that's very complicated. On the other hand, it's going, yeah, but on the other hand, it is just a nuts and bolts. Let's chase down the street. Let's pull out the guns. Let's have the gunfire. Let's have all the action stuff. And again, it ends up falling between two stools. And it's yet another example of a case in which a movie seemed to be directed by three different people. There's the director's vision, there's the writer's vision, and there's the producer's vision, and they're not all pulling in the same way. So for the first 25 minutes, it was like, okay, fine, I'll buy this. It's an intelligent thriller. It obviously nods to movies that I like, and it has a central concept, which is interesting. After about the first half an hour gone, it started to go completely mad. It's like, oh, no, fine, we're just into nuts and bolts, car crashes and stuff going bang. And that's not that interesting. Plus, all the characters are merely ciphers for the device about the points of view. You never believe in any of them. You never really believe that they are who they say they are. And which means you kind of become emotionally detached, which is something that isn't helped by the structure. If you're going to do that structure, you have to do it rigorously and you have to make the film work in a way that fulfills its intellectual criteria. You can't just downshift and say, OK, we had half an hour of cleverness. Now let's blow some stuff up.
You mentioned Paul Greengrass. Breaking news, according to Variety magazine, Matt Damon and Paul Greengrass will return
are getting married
for a new installment of the Bourne franchise. This Greengrass really indicated on this programme that he would only do if Tottenham Hotspur finished in the top four of the Premiership, something which is extremely unlikely to happen. In fact, it's impossible to happen. However, according to Variety, that's exactly what's going to happen, which I'm very surprised. I suspect that's not true. I don't know what they can do with it because it was all finished and wrapped up.
Well, I thought the whole deal was exactly as he said, that he would only do it if Tottenham Hotspur did this thing, which you, being a Spurs fan, it means nothing to me, said it wasn't going to happen. So, you know, I'll believe it when I see it. I mean, bear in mind, Variety announcing that something is happening doesn't mean it actually is happening. It just means that they're announcing that it's happening.
Jennifer in Brighton says, hello, chaps. I was born with six fingers. Can someone make a film about me? Adam in Lewisham, get the good doctor to count down his fingers on one hand.
Yeah, I know how this works.
Then add the fingers on his other hand, which is a great trick.
This is a trick that I talk to my children and they enjoy it every time. Look, I've got 11 fingers. So, do you want to? I mean, people understand how that works, don't they? You know, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6 plus 5 is 11. Boom.
James in Ramsbottom says Hannibal Lecter's sixth finger isn't in the films, it's just in the books. Robin Hastings, being a U2 fan, I'd be very interested to hear of your goal to make Mark realise the error of his ways in trying to get him to admire their music. Last week I went to see The Diving Bell and The Butterfly at the cinema and thought it was wonderful in terms of the acting, the script and the use of a U2 song in the soundtrack, Ultraviolet from Acton Baby. I was wondering if, just as Mark had to change his rule about Chris Columbus after finding out that he'd written Gremlins, does this have any impact on his opinion of the band?
No, and in fact, that's a very interesting point, because there is a precedent for that, which is I absolutely loved Tell No One. I thought that French thriller based on the Harlan Coben novel was absolutely brilliant. And there is a key sequence in that in which they play that terrible "With or Without You," that one.
It's a good song,
and
that.
Even though every single, it's a rubbish song, every single atom in my body is going, no, no, so bad, so wrong, so please turn it off. But of course, it's a plot point. It's a very, very important plot point because it's to do with the place that they were, that the two characters were together when they saw U2 play live. And there was a moment when I had a bit of a cold sweat and I thought, I'm going to actually have to not like this movie now because of the U2's involvement in it. But it was wonderfully got round. In the case of The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, it's just having one song in Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which in fact, the most important music from that film is Tom Waits. And I think one Tom Waits pretty much counteracts one U2. And in fact, I think there's two Tom Waits songs in Diving Bell.
If you had to pick a movie of the week, what would it be, sir?
Well, I think it would probably be Diary of the Dead, just because I despite the fact that it's not massively groundbreaking and it's not going to change the world, it's got its heart in the right place, which is in some deep, dark, grim place. I wanted so much more to like The Boleyn Girl, but it is, in the end, all over the shop. So, Diary of the Dead.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.